Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello, let's do it again. It's time to learn and improve your American English skills with the Voice of America. Today we have two interesting stories for you. First, we will hear about a small business in the western United States that helps young people to change their lives for the better. Then we're off to the Middle East to hear how music is bringing together Arabs and Jews. It is time to listen and learn with As It Is from VOA. First up is Marcia James with a story of hope for some young people whose lives are being made better by the place they work. Marcia?
Denver, Colorado is one of the fastest growing cities in the United States. It also has one of the biggest populations of homeless young people. A Denver coffee shop is seeking to resolve the problem. The Purple Door Coffee Shop employs and trains homeless young people, giving them a second chance to make a new start.
Welcome. What can I get started for you guys?
For many years of his life, Kevin Parsons lived on the street. Today, he is working behind the counter of an espresso bar, serving coffee. He is also working to move off the streets and into a home.
The struggle to get a job even when you have a house nowadays, but when you don't have a house, trying to get a job is so much harder.
What makes it a little easier is the mission of the Purple Door Coffee Shop. It does not just serve a cup of coffee, it turns lives around. The owners of the two-year-old nonprofit hire 3 to 4 young adults per year. Shelters such as Urban Peak, where Kevin was staying, recommend young people who are ready to commit to working. Kim Easton, who runs Urban Peak, says the partnership between the shelter and the coffee shop is important.
When someone has lived in chronic stress and trauma for as long as these young people have, every day fighting for survival, they haven't had the opportunity nor the example of how to learn conflict management, how to manage money, how to cook a meal, how to pay their rent on time, nor do they understand even why that's important.
Those skills are exactly what employment at Purple Door offer. Madison Chandler is co-founder of Purple Door. She and her partner meet with their workers individually each week. They talk about topics ranging from mental health, finance, hygiene, and customer service. They also provide a life coach to make sure the workers have the support and skills that will set them up for success. Madison Chandler says at the end of Purple Door's first year, their 4 graduates were ready to start a new part of their lives. The experience at the coffee shop helped them get jobs.
Our very first guy that ever graduated from the program, he's been working at an auto parts warehouse since he left, which has been over a year now.
So some bills that you can expect to pay every month?
Kevin recognizes that he is learning what he needs to leave the struggles of homelessness and learn the skills to live a full life.
They seem to have the philosophy that they don't want to change us, they want to help us change ourselves. Wonderful. Do either of you want to pour?
Kevin says he is used to being kicked out of stores and treated with disrespect. Now, for the first time in his life, he is being trusted with money, handling food, and enjoying conversations with customers. In the short time Kevin has been in the program, he says it's already giving him the support, love, and opportunity he and many others without homes need but are denied.
It's been so helpful just to have structure and to have like a purpose and a goal that's like tangible.
For Madison Chandler, providing these young adults with employment and education and helping them become confident and independent is the most rewarding part of her job.
The more rewarding things are watching somebody start to believe in themselves and to believe that they can achieve a life for themselves that they've dreamed of, or to believe that they're worth it even.
As for Kevin, who turns 25 this month, living in a home and having a job to come to will be the best gift he can give himself. I'm Marcia James.
You are listening to the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. In Israel, music is bringing young people together and to make more than just beautiful sounds. Four young musicians, two Israeli Jews, two Israeli Arabs, perform under the name of Polyphony Quartet. The Israel-based Polyphony Foundation formed the group. Here's Katie Weaver with more on the story.
Revital Bendersky and Shar Hayat play the violin. They are Jewish. Palestinian Christian Faris Mashour is also a violinist and plays the viola. Cello player Mahdi Sadi is Muslim. Polyphony began in 2006 at a small school in Nazareth to bring classical music to Arab children. Nabil Aboud Ashkar is the founder and music director. He says the chance for classical music education was not available to Arab children.
There was never a real proper opportunities for young Arab children to learn classical music. And this is what we were able to change. We showed everyone that there's no reason why an Arab kid shouldn't be able to play classical music on a high standard.
The school grew as teachers, most of them Israeli Jews, drove 2 hours from Tel Aviv to teach the children. Then Polyphony was formed with two goals: further music education and bring together young Palestinian and Jewish classical music students to perform. Friendships developed among people who would have no reason to meet without Polyphony. Mahdi Sadi says the experience made a major difference in his life.
Polyphony changed all my thinking and how I see people, how to accept them, and how to be accepted also. Yeah, I never had a Jewish friend before, and I never thought that I will have.
Revital Bendersky feels similarly.
I started looking at things a bit differently, and like Mahdi said, I never had Arab friends before, and it started all in Polyphony.
The relationships grow and deepen through shared goals, as Mahdi Sadi describes.
For example, rehearsals. We do rehearsals, we start to know each other more, and we start to trust each other in the concerts. In case of somebody do mistake, we always need somebody to help us, to support. Yeah, so we're more as a family team, family music team.
The project's musicians visited New York City recently to perform. At the city's Unitarian Church of All Souls, Polyphony Quartet played a piece by Mozart. Among those listening were Craig and Deborah Kogut, co-founders of Polyphony. Their financial support has expanded the program to train 130 teachers, and this year, Polyphony's music education programs in elementary schools and kindergartens are projected to reach 10,000 other young Israeli Arabs. I'm Katie Weaver.
This is VOA, the Voice of America. We come to you every day from Washington.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Education Report. EF Education First, a private education company, is working with LinkedIn to test members of the business social networking site on the language of business, English. The idea is simple. When LinkedIn users in non-English speaking countries update their profiles, they will be asked if they would like to take the FSET test. The FSET test is a free online standardized English test from EF Education First. Users can then post their certified FSET test results on their LinkedIn profile. The EF LinkedIn partnership offers English learners a free and convenient way to demonstrate their English ability online. Several companies have online English proficiency tests. They often place a student into a level of an online teaching program associated with the company. Most of the tests just measure knowledge of grammar, vocabulary, and reading. Students preparing for a standardized test of English should also check their listening skill. Exam English has free online tests that include listening comprehension sections. The test taker listens to an audio clip and answers questions about it. Colleges and universities accept international students based on their test scores or placement on a widely accepted proficiency scale, like the Common European Framework of Reference, CEFR. Employers decide on their own which test results to accept for international applicants. Since online tests do not have a way to proctor the test taker, their results are best for a casual self-assessment by the learner, or as a tool to guide study. Putting them on social media, such as a LinkedIn profile, means the scores are available to anyone on the internet. Ming Chun is the Director of Research and Academic Partnerships at EF. He says sharing test scores on social media may affect a person's reputation.
If you say on LinkedIn that you have an EF 80 score, then you go into an interview and you clearly do not have an advanced level of English, then that's your reputation at stake.
Mr. Chun says the eyes of the world should encourage truthful reporting of test scores.
I actually think that social networks keep us more honest. On a traditional resume, only the interviewer sees your resume, but your LinkedIn profile, the whole world can see it.
It is too early to tell if EF's collaboration with LinkedIn will be a success. But one thing is sure, you can't beat the price. I'm Jill Robbins.
¶¶
Welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember.
Three days from now, after half a century in the service of our country, I shall lay down the responsibilities of office as, in traditional and solemn ceremony, the authority of the presidency is vested in my successor. This evening, I come to you with a message of leave-taking and farewell, and to share a few final thoughts with you, my countrymen.
Dwight Eisenhower was elected president in 1952. The following year, the Korean War ended with an armistice, a ceasefire agreement. During his presidency, Eisenhower began a tradition of meetings between the leaders of the United States and the Soviet Union. He met with Soviet leaders Nikolai Bulganin and Nikita Khrushchev. These meetings may have helped reduce the threat of a nuclear war between the two countries during the Cold War. By 1960, Eisenhower had served two terms. The Constitution was changed to prevent presidents from being elected more than twice after Franklin Roosevelt won four times.
We now stand 10 years past the midpoint of a century that has witnessed four major wars among great nations. Three of these involved our own country. Despite these holocausts, America is today the strongest, the most influential, and most productive nation in the world. Understandably proud of this preeminence, we yet realize that America's leadership and prestige depend not merely upon our unmatched material progress, riches, and military strength, but on how we use our power in the interest of world peace and human betterment throughout America's corporations. Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together.
At the end of Eisenhower's first term, he was still very popular. He had suffered a heart attack, but the Republican president felt strong enough to campaign again in 1956. His Democratic Party opponent was Adlai Stevenson. They had been the candidates in the presidential election 4 years earlier. This time, Eisenhower won almost 10 million more votes than Stevenson, an even bigger victory than in 1952. Eisenhower's second term, however, presented problems. The Soviet Union launched the space age by putting the first satellite into orbit around Earth. Fidel Castro established a communist government in Cuba. Many white Americans were fighting the Supreme Court's decision to end racial separation in schools.
and the American economy suffered a recession. Eisenhower's popularity dropped during his second term. This would make it difficult for the Republican Party's next candidate for president. The delegates who attended the presidential nominating convention in the summer of 1960 feared that their party would lose the election in November. They had to find the strongest candidate possible. Many believed that Richard Nixon was the strongest. Nixon had been a senator and a member of the House of Representatives. He had been Eisenhower's vice president for 8 years. When Eisenhower suffered several serious illnesses, Nixon had a chance to show his abilities to lead the nation. He showed great strength while facing an angry crowd during a trip to South America. He also gained support when he defended the United States to Khrushchev during a trip to the Soviet Union. Nixon's closest opponent for the Republican nomination was Nelson Rockefeller. Rockefeller was the governor of New York State. He came from one of the richest families in America. Richard Nixon easily won the support of the party. The delegates nominated him on the first vote. He accepted the nomination, and he called for new efforts for peace and freedom around the world. The race for the Democratic nomination was much more difficult. The Democratic Party thought it would have no problem winning the presidential election. Many candidates entered the race for the nomination. One was Senator Hubert Humphrey of Minnesota. Another was Senator John Kennedy of Massachusetts. Humphrey had been elected to the Senate 3 times. He was a strong activist for civil rights and peace. Kennedy was a Navy hero in World War II. He was handsome and only 43 years old. He was also Roman Catholic. No Catholic had ever been elected president of the United States. Kennedy and Humphrey began to compete in state primary elections, the first step in the nominating process. Kennedy won an important primary in Wisconsin. But voters in Protestant areas of that state did not support him. The question then became, could he win in another state, West Virginia? Most of the voters in that state were Protestant. On the last night of the primary campaign in West Virginia, Kennedy spoke about his religion. He said, "The President of the United States promises to defend the Constitution. And that," he said, "includes the separation of the government from any religion or church." Kennedy won a big victory in West Virginia. He then went on to win many votes in other primaries. He received the nomination on the first vote at the Democratic Convention. In his acceptance speech, he said he would ask Americans to help their country and sacrifice for their country. After the party conventions, the two candidates, Kennedy and Nixon, began to campaign around the country. Nixon charged that Kennedy was too young to be president. He said Kennedy did not know enough about governing. Kennedy attacked the Republican record of the past 8 years. He said President Eisenhower and Vice President Nixon had not done enough to bring progress to the nation. Protestant groups expressed concerns about Kennedy's religion. They wondered if he would be influenced by the Pope. They wondered if the leader of the Roman Catholic Church would try to make policy for the United States. Kennedy answered by repeating his strong support for the constitutional separation of church and state. Public opinion surveys showed the election campaign to be very close. Then the candidates agreed to hold four debates on television. In the first debate, the candidates showed they did not differ too widely on major issues. Kennedy appeared calm and sure, but Nixon did not feel well. He appeared thin and tired. Many people who had not considered voting for Kennedy now began to change their minds. To them, he looked more presidential. Most people seemed to feel that Kennedy won the first debate. Nixon probably won the second one. And both men did about the same in the last two. In the fourth debate, they expressed widely different opinions about whether the United States was making progress. Kennedy believed there had been little progress under Eisenhower and Nixon.
Franklin Roosevelt said in 1936 that that generation of Americans had a rendezvous with destiny. I believe in 1960 and 61 and 2 and 3, we have a rendezvous with destiny. And I believe it incumbent upon us to be the defenders of the United States and the defenders of freedom. And to do that, we must give this country leadership, and we must get America moving again.
Nixon disagreed. He believed the United States had not been standing still, but there was more to be done.
It is essential, with the conflict that we have around the world, that we not just hold our own, that we not keep just freedom for ourselves. It is essential that we extend freedom, extend it to all the world. And this means more than what we've been doing. It means keeping America even stronger militarily than she is. It means seeing that our economy moves forward even faster than it has. It means making more progress in civil rights than we have, so that we can be a splendid example for all the world to see.
Another issue in the 1960 presidential debates was the Chinese attack on the islands of Quemoy and Matsu in the Taiwan Strait. And another was how to deal with Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev. After the debates, the presidential candidates campaigned around the country again. Nixon proposed that if he were elected, he would travel to Eastern Europe and meet with Khrushchev. Kennedy proposed the Peace Corps, a program to send Americans to developing countries to provide technical aid and other help. On election day in November, the voters chose John Kennedy as their 35th president. His victory, however, was a close one. Almost 69 million people voted. Kennedy won by fewer than 120,000 votes. The beginning of his presidency will be our story next week. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and pictures at voaspecialenglish.com. And you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English.